You are listening to 2SER. This is Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds here on your Murder Mystery World Tour once again. And Herds, this time it is my turn to step into the arena with our new book, A Good Murder. You want to tell us a bit about it, Herds?
Yeah. It's A Good Murder by Robert Gott. This is an Australian author, and the murder itself is set in Australia, in the humble old town of Maryborough. And yeah, it's exciting because this is our first book that we've actually touched on that is set in Australia. So I'm excited to be on home turf. You've got the advantage here, Flex. I'm sure you'll struggle to solve the, what is it, three murders potentially that I've given you in the first couple of chapters. I hope you're appreciating that. The sheer volume of murder contained within this book is astounding.
Yeah, we lose Polly Drummond, we lose their mother, we lose Fred Drummond, all in pretty quick succession in the first four chapters of the story.
Yeah, I wanted to jump into this book because it is the often idolized, generally poorly executed satire of murder mystery. That is the kind of genre that this book sits in. And as I'm sure you've experienced, and I'm sure that you can, if you go online, you have a look at how people, you know, thought about this book. It's got mixed reception. Some people think this is a fantastic novel, and it is an entertaining book, I would say, but there are some stumbles, and especially the main character is, he's kind of the worst.
Kind of is an understatement.
Yeah.
I will say, I think that one of the important things is we do always say at the beginning of every show that this is your murder mystery world tour, and we're taking you around the world, and sometimes it can feel perhaps like that tour is a bit disconnected from what we're actually doing on the show. But I think that this book is an excellent point to look back on how far we've come this year, because we've gone through covering the theater with Nio Marsh and Stella Duffy, going further into it with Simon Brett, kind of looking at adaptations of it, getting more towards the Australian circuit and the detectives that are a bit more disconnected and modern written, and further away from the standard amateur detective that most people think of. And I think that this book, in a way, is a culmination of a lot of those things that we have covered. It's all of these themes that we've had so far thrown into one book.
Yeah, for sure.
And along the way, I think that I have appreciated and really enjoyed how all of these themes have been used. But doing them all at once is just too much.
It's a bit of a mess. It's a bit of a shamble of cobbled together ideas. I specifically chose The Good Murder, or just Good Murder, because I wanted to pick something kind of lighthearted, something to pull ourselves back from all this political drama.
Yeah, based on what I've read in here, Robert Gott is a very intense writer in a unique way.
Oh my goodness, yes.
everything that happens is given a lot of detail. Everything that happens is explained through perhaps extravagant metaphor.
Yep.
And I mean, on the one hand, I love it because the description of the viscera and the horrors of the scene at the murder of the Drummond mother is
it's indulgent, right?
It's like, indulgent is an excellent word for it.
Can we talk about that scene? He literally, look, the man, Will Powell, is going to I don't even remember why he's there. I think he's trying to like find evidence as to who's killed Mrs. Drummond's daughter, Polly, whatever it is. It doesn't really matter, but he's there. This is the thing. The scenes are more important than the plot, if that, I think that's a good way to describe it.
I'd back that.
He ends up in the Drummond house and he's, you know, trying to figure out what's going on, and he can feel the presence of the murder, and there's this really tense moment, and that's what he sees, as you say, the severed head and the viscera. But there is a beautiful comical moment where he drops his torchlight and it rolls under the bed, and he you kind of get put into his mindset as he dives under the bed trying to grab the torch, and of course the entire ground is slick with blood, so he just gets covered in the stuff, and there's this like extended sequence of him trying to like get the blood off, and then he goes to like have a bath in the stream, and he gets hit on the, like, it is indulgent almost to a fault. It's ridiculous, like the amount of sticky situations he gets himself into for no other reason than because the author wants to see him suffer, it's mind-blowing.
Now, before we get into the actual crimes in the last part of the show today, Herds, I did want to discuss with you whether I am reading this book and discovering that I'm actually just a prude. Because there are so many moments in this book, particularly when we have the female characters introduced, where William Power's immediate assessment is, oh my goodness, she was gorgeous. I was immediately aroused.
Yep.
She radiated sex. And I was sitting here at my desk reading this book, and I just about closed it once I got to the second of those descriptions. And I'm not sure, Herds, if that marks me as a prude who has no taste for the whimsical and ludicrous, or whether it is actually just like a step too far, because we have covered previously this year Charles Paris, who you mentioned before we came on to record today, that a lot of people say that Charles Paris is an example of this type of actor detective, somewhat farcical, done better.
Well, not just actor, but also like kind of unlikable. Like Charles Paris suffers a lot from people not liking him, not cooperating with him, being suspected in murder cases. We've covered quite a few modern novels that have the detective being like the prime suspect in the murder, which is an interesting trend we're noticing.
Is it because of my personal tastes you think that this is falling flat for me, or do you think that there is actually a explicit excess in how this is written?
I think both are true. I think that there is a deliberate excess because we have to remember this William character is being written to be unlikable, but he's also supposed to be someone that we can laugh at when bad things happen to him. Like the fact that the sort of love interest sort of character, Annie, who's part of his troop, is dating the constable who's trying to arrest him is funny because of his horrible sexist remarks and opinions of her. It's supposed to show us how superficial he is, right? It's supposed to show us how unlikable this man is. So I agree that it is in excess of what any normal person should be thinking. I do not think that you are prudish. But I do also think that you need to have a certain mindset going into this, that this is going to be a novel about over-the-top characters who are, bordering on the edge of antagonists, even, the way that Will goes about judging everyone he meets.
I will say, I think the thing that worked for me with Charles Paris is that I always could see through Charles Paris that Simon Brett was expressing an exaggerated form of his disconnection from the modern world and how Charles Paris had, the world had gone past him, basically. Whereas with William Power, it feels so disconnected from how anyone, I think, would reasonably perceive things that it, I can't see Robert Gott's lens through it. Not to say that I think that Robert Gott is some deranged fool on the other end of on the other end of the pen, but that there is a gap there that I can't quite mentally close.
Let's put it this way. I think that the way that Robert Gott is writing a sex pervert is similar to the way that you see like teenagers written in horror movies, when the writers clearly don't know how teenagers actually talk, where they're like radical I'll catch you. Like, there's this like really exaggerated, like, yo, I'm punk as heck, y'all. Like, me trying to pretend to be a, an old man, pretending to be a young person. Yeah.
It feels disconnected because Robert Gott cannot be that person.
Yeah, he is not that person. And that is very much a strength of Charles Paris, is that his mindset is so close to the author, whereas Robert Gott he's trying to drive his, forgive the metaphor, but he's trying to drive his protagonist like a stolen car and see how fast he can go rather than trying to create something that he himself connects with, right?
I think that kind of has tempered my perspective on William Power a bit.
Well, that's good.
The way that you've described that, because I was quite admittedly frustrated with the main character thus far. And I think that perhaps going into the rest of the book with that lens will allow me to see things with a bit more objectivity.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Well, we will close that here. We are going to talk more, of course, in the last part of the show about the mystery and how it fits together. We are talking A Good Murder by Robert Gott, the first of the William Power novels. This is Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds, and we'll be back with more of that in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are talking Robert Gott's Good Murder. And joining me, Flex, on the line is Robert Gott himself. Robert has published many children's books, is a newspaper cartoonist with The Adventures of a Naked Man, and enters our wheelhouse with the William Power Mystery Series and The Holiday Murders. Robert, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks very much.
So, Robert, we have to get this out of the gate because we're here and we've been discussing this book and I have been giving you a ribbing for the past 10 minutes on this show. And I first of all want to apologize because my co-host, Herds, assures me that I will enjoy this book by the end. But why did you make William Power so obnoxious?
Because he's an actor.
Uh-huh.
Surely that's self-evident.
I see. You have a bit of a gripe with actors. You think that there's an inherent character trait that leads them to be like William Powell.
Well, when I was trying to come up with the protagonist, I needed someone who was self-centered, not very bright, solipsistic, unobservant, but also narcissistic. And of course, it's only one profession that fits that bill. So he had to be an actor.
Yeah.
And it was also very handy because the books were set in World War II and I needed a character who could move around a bit and actors were in a protected profession. And I wanted to create a character who was awful. I wanted to create a complete and utter dickhead. And it didn't really bother me whether people would find him unpleasant. Lots of people find him unpleasant.
Yeah.
And even more bizarrely, there are people who like him.
That's so strange to me.
And in the Will Power series, I think I was just more concerned with making it a kind of farce. In the genre of farce, everything is big. Everything is heightened. I got to the point where I thought that was entertaining. Every time he opens his mouth, he says something offensive. He never gets anything right. He puts people's lives in danger, and he's an asshole.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, but that's a good farcical character. But there is one thing that I will defend him about, and that is that he doesn't have any malice about him. He may be stupid, but he's not malicious.
Yeah. I can definitely see that current kind of running under things. You have written this story that is set in your hometown of Maryborough, and it's set during World War II. It's set as this farce. Why that setting for this farce? Was it the feeling of familiarity as well as the kind of separation in history from World War II that allows you to insert something so whimsical in there?
Yeah, well, I knew that World War II, in terms of crime fiction in Australia, was a very underexplored period of time. And I grew up in Maryborough. With everyone who grows up in Maryborough knows the story. This is a tragic thing that happened. In 1942, a young woman who was, I think, 21 years old, she went missing. But 2 weeks after she went missing, she was found pretty much in the town's water tower, which meant that she was dissolving in the town's water supply. And that meant that everyone in the town had been drinking her and, you know, washing their hair with her and brushing their teeth with her. And that included my parents. And as a kid growing up, we were aware of that story. And I loved the idea that my parents were cannibals. Just loved it. But what was fascinating to me was that when I went up to Maryborough to start doing research, when I spoke to Catholics in the town, they still held the view that Molly had become pregnant. Mm. Not Molly. Molly was the name of the real person. Molly had become pregnant to a prominent Protestant businessman.
Yeah.
And that he murdered her in order to protect himself and his family. And then when I spoke to the Protestants in the town, elderly people here, they had the notion that she'd become pregnant to the Catholic priest who was French. And, you know, that's what the French do. And so the Catholic priest had murdered her to protect his reputation.
Mm.
Now, both of those things are utterly, utterly absurd. And yet they survive in the town's general collective memory as a suspicion, even to this day. And they're totally untrue. And it did cause confusion in the town because one of the book launches was in Maryborough when it came out. And people at the book launch, they keep coming up to me and saying, I'm so glad you've written this because now we can finally find out what happened. Okay, No. This is... It's got nothing to do.
Oh my goodness.
Except that the novel opens with a body in a water tower. This has got nothing to do with the real case. But I could make them understand. And the newspaper published the original front page story of the finding of the original body.
Mm.
And it was awful because the descendants of that poor girl who'd taken her own life are still in Maribor. And it brought up all kinds of bad memories and things. And I briefly felt terrible.
That's such a peculiar story. I mean, you know, hearing that actually comes from a real incident is, you know, kind of really changes the perspective, I guess, I have of the crime in this book, because that element of the historical backing to it is that's such a peculiar way to, I guess, have that integrated and perceived by the culture that it came from.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I'm also very, very interested in notions of collective memory. And I did my PhD on collective memory.
Mm.
And I'm very interested in the way cultures form collective memories around a particular incident, which in collective memory theory is called a memory site. And they can be unshakable in their belief about that, even though there's no evidence to support it. But it just gets rooted in the culture and taken as fact.
I guess one of the fascinating things, you worked with Solari Gentil for All the Tears in China, which we just covered on the show.
Yeah.
And you both kind of have this background in historical fiction. You spoke at the Bad Crime Festival in Sydney last year about that. So when it comes to looking at that collective memory and dealing with these cultures and the research and how people remember things, I guess looking back on All the Tears in China and how that dealt so much with the collective memory of the Chinese people and how they reacted to the events leading up to World War II and their societal changes, and then also how you've spoken about Maribor here. The idea of collective memory, I guess, in crime fiction is something that is a really big undercurrent, because there's always that idea that the detective is looking for the absolute truth, but collective memory is almost inherently a contradiction to that. You know,
it is.
How can you kind of juggle those two concepts when they're so intrinsically linked?
Well, they're fascinating because, I mean, in the real world, nothing is binary. Everything is fluid. And even if we take, say, memory sites in relation to collective memory, they shift and change as well. In my other series, which is much darker, although it's set in the same period, set in the 1940s during the war.
Mm.
And in that, I look at things that are much, much darker and more disturbing. And what really interested me about the 1940s especially, and what got me onto collective memory, was when did we actually come to understand that something as profound as the Holocaust actually was taking place and had taken place? Most people who I would speak to would say, well, we understood that the Holocaust happened at the end of the war, when the camps were liberated. But I looked at newspapers throughout the war, and there were reports from about 1942 onwards of massacres in Europe, concentration camps in Europe, mostly targeted towards the Jews.
Mm.
And it was there in the newspapers. And it just interested me that sort of fell out of Australia's memory and didn't re-enter it until the end of the war. Now, it was competing with a lot of other war news, I guess, at the time. And it wasn't until the photographs started to appear in the newspapers in 1945 that it started to coalesce into what we might call a collective memory.
Yeah. I mean, that is such an interesting idea that I guess we've kind of inadvertently covered it on the show, this separation between people's ideas and memories of events, such as when we spoke with Simon Brett about how interpretations around the death penalty had changed after World War II, who did a similar story about an obnoxious actor solving crime, talking about how that crime ended in a way that it was perceived publicly very differently to how it actually happened, even within the book. And I mean, that is... You've opened my eyes here, Robert, to something that we've been talking about for so long, but never really packaged and condensed into one idea. That's amazing.
All I heard then was obnoxious actor and thought, So that's where the initial idea came from anyway. A real event, which I turned into an exercise in comedy.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for joining us here on this episode talking about your book, Good Murder. one of the William Power mystery series. I cannot wait to have you back on at the end of this to talk a bit more about how this all wraps up in the end, especially with this new context that we've had. I'm so excited to get to it.
Oh, thank you so much.
You are listening to Death of the Reader. This is Flex and Herds here, your murder mystery world tour. And we have taken a deep step into the mud with A Good Murder by Robert Gott.
Yes, a good murder, of course, is what this book is called. Not just good murder.
Oh, is it? Have I made a fool of myself?
You have made a bit of a fool of yourself there, sir. So you see, it's called Good Murder because there is more than one murder.
You know what? That is astoundingly obvious in hindsight.
Yes. only someone who has not read the book would call it A Good Murder because they are suspecting that there will only be one murder.
Are you accusing me of something, sir? Are you accusing me of something?
Have you read the book or have you just read the Wikipedia page? This is the question.
Does this book have a Wikipedia page?
I don't know. Hold on. I'm gonna find out. I hope it does because otherwise that joke doesn't make any sense.
You know what? We should make it after this episode. We're gonna go in and we're gonna make a Wikipedia page.
Let's do it.
So Robert Gott's Good Murder is a book, Herds, that we will now be unraveling the first to fourth chapters of in regards to its mystery. And I have to admit, Herds, as I've said in the first part of this episode, I've had a tough time with this book.
Oh, yeah?
I think that it is excellently written for somebody other than me. And my normal method when it comes to solving murder mysteries is to read through the section we have allocated, make a couple of guesses, you know, pinpoint who my main suspects are, and then reread with those suspects in mind and seeing how the pieces would fall into place. I could not bring myself to reread this. I'll be entirely honest. I am going to force myself to do it for next episode because there are points on the line.
You better.
But I will say that at least this far in the story, I am holding on by the skin of my teeth. Can I make a bargain with you, Herds?
Sure. What's the bargain?
Can I just outright sacrifice my first point today for this book in our double or nothing game?
Okay.
To just get the culprit and motive for next week.
You're not sure. If you wanna just focus on reading it through the one time and not going back over and over it, I'm okay with that.
Because I do not think, based on the way that this novel has been presented thus far, that the method is going to be as significant.
Sure.
And I will throw that point down on the table to make that claim.
Sure, sure.
Because I think if you look at the crimes, for example, we have Polly, Fred, and their mother. The only crime that really screams method complexity to me is Fred, who goes down in a blaze of glory?
Question mark. With his flight instructor, apparently, yeah.
Yeah, with his flight instructor from the RAAF.
It's such a weird scene. Will shows up and is like, Fred, I did not kill any members of your family. And Fred's like, yeah, I know you didn't, and I'm going to find out where they are. And Will's like, who's they? Who killed? He's like, they. And he like fades into the shadows, hops in a plane and explodes. He just falls in the river.
Yeah, that is the only one that I can think of that really has a like complex method.
Sure.
None of the others are locked rooms. None of the others really present any technical challenge from a murder mystery standpoint. So I think that the linchpin of this mystery is going to just be who knew who was going to be where. When? I will say that again. Who knew who was going to be where when?
Sure.
That is why I'm going to throw that point out just so that I can have some a bit of a safety net for this week because I am struggling. I'm also interested to see what the novel actually does bring in terms of the conclusion to this story. Because as I said, with very little technical complexity to the crimes, at least as I have seen them now.
For sure.
It may be revealed that there is more later on. I think that there isn't really much that we can do to conclude this novel, at least in the conventional mystery sense, because obviously books without technical complexity can have endings. Like that's ridiculous to suggest, but more that because in the mystery sense, there is no technical complexity, it doesn't feel like we are leading towards the roundup scene.
Yes,
it doesn't feel like we're leading towards the big summary of everything that happened. I feel like we're getting towards the criminal being cornered saying, I did this for you, or some rubbish like that to whoever they did it for. And that then being the concluding scene. You know, they just spill their guts and their heart, and we don't worry about the technical complexities.
Well, something that is interesting is that we also have all these police characters. And when I was reading the book at this point in the story, I was kind of wondering, no spoilers obviously, but kind of wondering if the conclusion of this novel was going to be that just the police figure everything out and William is cleared and he just looks like an idiot at the end. You know, like, is that the conclusion that we're going towards? Just
all of
the things that William has been doing up until this point, all of this investigating and is it all going to be for naught and somebody else is just going to solve it? But you're right. How does that lead to a satisfying conclusion if the person that we're following doesn't do anything important? Are we just here to watch him suffer? And that's entirely possible.
Yeah. Because as I said at the start of this episode, this book really brings so many of the elements from all of the other stories we've covered this year and just smashes them all into one book.
Yeah.
And I won't point out any particular examples because I don't want to go back and spoil the previous stories.
Sure.
But I think that so many of them were so strong in their ending. I'm concerned that one of the weaknesses of putting so many elements forth here is that we won't be able to wrap them up. And the way that the mystery is set up thus far concerns me most in that aspect.
Yeah, you're right. Like, what is there to explain at this point? You know, for whatever twists and turns there may be during the story, what is the explanation at the end for this murder mystery? Is it even worth considering as a murder mystery? That's something we'll have to see when we finish, obviously. But
because, you know, obviously this episode, we have been very hard on Robert Gott, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
In between our last book and this one, Herd said to me, you know, sometimes, Felix, I feel like you're coming in and you're giving these books too much of a nice treat.
I agree.
And I haven't come into this book with the intention of proving you wrong, Herd, but I do want to say that I think that Robert Gott has done an excellent job writing this book, and I do hope that it redeems itself in my heart, but I am very concerned thus far.
Yeah, that's all right. I mean, that's good. That's a healthy skepticism. And yeah, I agree. I think you have been far too lenient on some of the books and some of the movies. The movie, I would say, that just one of the movies that we've had on the show so far. You were very, very lenient on what I thought was a trash fire.
In my defense, Herds, my defense of that movie was that it was a very entertaining trash fire.
Okay. Still was a defense.
That's a different debate, though. That's a different debate.
Get out of here. Go listen to our episode on Miss Fisher and the Crypt of Tears for more on that.
Yes. Anyhow, I think, Herds, I am still rooting for Robert Gott. I think that this book has shone in ways that haven't quite reached me, and I hope that the rest of this book can make them stand out.
This may not be the most well-executed story. This may not be the most polished story, but I don't think that's what Robert Gott's priorities are.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a book that I have laughed more genuinely at, like, or with or at either, than any novel we've had in the last year, I'd say. Like, there are so many little moments where Robert Gott is just putting his main character through the ringer of pain and misery, and I have laughed so hard. I know that sounds awful, but I have laughed so hard at William Power more than I have in a long while on this show. So it's commendable, Robert Gott. Keep doing what you're doing. I love it.
Yeah. Well, I will say before we wrap up, Herds, I think that it is going to be Augie Kelly.
Okay.
Only because he is the one person that has had enough screen time to warrant it that hasn't outright been suspicious yet. That is my entire justification thus far.
Do you have a motive for him? Like, why he would want to kill
absolutely
an entire family?
Not. No. I am devoid. I am devoid of good information for you at this point.
Okay.
The two pieces of evidence I am functioning on is that I think that Robert Gott wants me to suspect Conroy.
Okay.
And that is too obvious.
That is too obvious.
And that Augie Kelly has had far too much screen time and heard far too many conversations.
Okay.
That's all I have to work with at this point.
We'll see if the second part of this story might change your mind. I will remind you that there is one other member of the Drummond family who is yet to make an appearance.
Yes.
So who knows? Maybe they have some info for us. Maybe they can alight us on some clues that'll help you solve the mystery. We'll look forward
to it. I certainly hope so.
Yeah, I feel that.
You are listening to Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds. Next week on the show, we will be discussing chapters 5-9 of Good Murder by Robert Gott. I hope both that you will join us and enjoy this story along with us, and that Robert Gott redeems himself.
Yay.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure, and we'll see you next time.
This is Death of the Reader. You're listening to 2SER.